This is Janet Thompson, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee on the 27th of October 2011. Janet Thompson.
My name is Janet Thompson, and I was born on the 6th of December 1942 in Sedgley, Staffordshire.
So you're now...
coming up to 69.
Yeah, okay. What sort of schooling did you have, Janet?
Fairly mixed, actually. I went to a private school where my mother was a teacher until I was nine, and that was in the West Midlands. And then we had to move to Berkshire as a sort of interim measure. We stayed with my grandfather in a little wooden chalet, and we thought we were going to be moving on somewhere else, so I didn't go to school for two terms. My sister was eventually sent to the local grammar school, so I had a term without anybody at home. And then I went, my mother got a job as a teacher at another private school, and I had 2 years there, and that's where I took my 11 plus.
Did you pass?
Yes, and went on to the grammar school, 11 miles away. And that was a co-educational school, and then Berkshire County Council, in its wisdom, decided to go from co-educational to single-sex schooling. So at the end of my fourth year, the girls were all shunted off to a horrible modern school 5 miles further away. So in the end, I travelled 16 miles to school, and I was there for 3 years, and that's where I took my O-levels and A-levels.
And then university followed, I presume?
Yes, yes.
What did you read?
Geology.
Where?
At Bedford College in London. In those days, one had to sit an entrance examination, and a school friend and I sat. She was going to read physics, I think, and I wanted to read geology. Since I hadn't done geology at school, I had to sit geography and physics papers. And when I went up for interview, having passed the exam, they shunted me off to the geography department, thinking, because I'd taken a geography exam, I wanted a geography degree. And they suddenly realised their error, and so I was moved along to the geology department, which was much smaller and much friendlier than the geography.
Well, what was so exciting about geology? Here you are, you've never done it. You were going to do a degree in it. What was the attraction?
Well, I had taken geography A-level, or was studying for it at the time, and I liked the physical geology side, which was all about landforms and why rocks had such an impact on the landforms. And I also wanted to do something that took me outside. I was an outdoors person. And I couldn't think of much to do with geography other than teach. And since my family were teachers, I didn't want to become a teacher. I wanted to be different. And geology seemed to be the best thing.
And what was your first knowledge of or brush with this place called the Antarctic? How did you first become aware of its existence?
Well, in my third year at university, I was the secretary of the geological club and organised the speakers for the club. And Dr. Adie came to give a talk about Antarctic geology. And as part of the committee, we all went out to the pub afterwards and gave him dinner. And when he sent his letter afterwards with expenses, he happened to say that he needed an assistant. And I wrote back and said I would be interested in doing that when I sent him his cheque. And he called me for an interview the Christmas before I took my finals. And I went up to Birmingham, because that's where the geology division was at the time, at the university. And didn't hear anything until just as I was revising, about to take my finals, and he said, "We have finally selected you to come and join us." Well, in fact, I think there was only one other applicant, and we both got jobs.
Oh, right. So, I mean, I know you talked about gender issues with British Library, and we're not going to cover the same ground again, but just out of interest, you must have been one of the first women to work for BAS, mustn't you?
Yes, as a scientist. He asked if I would come as soon as I'd graduated. Well, I'd already agreed to go around Scotland with my mother and uncle on a tour, so I said I wouldn't be free until the middle of August. And I went up, and yes, that I was the only female in the department because there were no female students in the university at the time reading geology. So there were three secretarial staff, and me were the only females.
So stop me if I got this wrong. Did you become the first female scientist at BAS simply because nobody else applied?
No, they didn't look for female scientists. The only reason that Dr. Ady had wanted to have a female assistant was because he'd had several male assistants and they'd all got so interested they'd applied to go south. So he kept losing his assistants. And because at the time women were not allowed to go south, he thought he was on to a dead search. You know, he'd keep the assistant for a bit longer than a year.
So rather perversely, it was the attitude, the negative attitude towards women that got you the job.
Yes. In a way, yes. I never thought about it like that. And then the other lady joined about a month later from Edinburgh, and she was working on research for a book, whereas I was a sort of general assistant to the Dr. Ady.
Now, I've been specifically asked to talk to you about mapping and magic, and we may have time later to talk about other things in your career, but I want to ask you, first of all, some of these notes have come from Joe Ray. Very obvious question, really. Why is mapping important to geological research? Why do you need to bother with drawing up maps?
Well, when you go into the field and you travel around all the different rock exposures, you need to be able to make a map of the different types of rock at different exposures. So you can make notes, of course, but to actually get a planimetric view of where you've been and how the rocks change over a geographical area is actually very important. So when the geologists went into the field to begin with, when I first joined, they always had a surveyor. It would be two men working together with their own sledges and husky teams, and the surveyor was taking coordinates of major peaks and producing sketch maps, and then the geologist was working, and it was only after they got back to the UK that any maps could be prepared, and then the geology plotted out. So it was not the most ideal at that time, and it improved when we got more advanced with mapping.
Well, you became in charge of mapping in 84, is that correct?
No. MAGIC wasn't created until 89, but I was working on geological maps, making them from 65 onwards, actually. They were fairly crude in the 65 version. And then in 78, BAS started to compile some better topographic base maps for a geological map series.
Tell me a bit more about those early maps, the maps you were faced with in the 60s when you first joined. What sort of condition were they in?
When you think that the Antarctic Peninsula is about the same length as the UK, and there were 200,000 to 250,000 maps at the northern end of the peninsula. There was, I think, just one 25,000 scale map, and the rest were 100,000 to 200,000 sketch maps with perhaps a few contours on, and there'd be big sheets of paper and not much else. In fact, there was one at, 71, 72 degrees south, which was a huge sheet of paper, and it just had a single spot height in the middle with a little dotted line round as a contour. That was all they knew at the time. So it had a geographical grid and not much else on it. And there were a lot of maps like that, so that you had the basic outcrop pattern on these maps and contours, but they were all sketchy and based on the surveyors doing over snow traverses. And in the northern part of the peninsula, they were based on aerial photography as well, but there was none farther south to speak of.
So was it the poor quality of those maps that actually kind of captured your interest in mapping?
Yes, it was a bit like doing a crossword puzzle, really, trying to get something sensible out of all these. And there was another aspect to it, that a lot of the geologists who came didn't complete their research. They published a few papers, but there was no comprehensive pulling together of all that they'd found. And in 1978, we decided that we really should pull all these 50-odd geologists together, you know, their work together. So there was quite a nice feeling of getting it all out into the public domain, all the research that had gone on before. And we had by then satellite imagery to help us make a sensible stab at showing the real area of rock outcrop in the Antarctic Peninsula, and then we could plot the different colours of the geology to make a geological map from those.
When the satellite images started to come in, we were a bit shocked at how inaccurate the panelling maps have been.
Indeed, yes. I mean, we were plotting at 1 to 250,000, which is a reasonable medium scale, and the four sheets that had been made at that scale at the northern end of the Antarctic Peninsula had been based on aerial photography, so they weren't too bad. Mm. Everything else, it was a vast improvement. And coastline was shown to be in rather different positions sometimes. You know, they it had been under cloud on when they took the aerial photography, so there would be a dotted line where the coastline was. Dragons be here sort of thing.
Can you expand a bit upon the process then? Those early maps that you were facing in the 1960s, can you give me a more detailed account of how they would have been drawn up and who would have done it?
It was done by... They were drawn by the Director of Overseas Surveys based in Kingston. So the surveying and mapping side was all under the control of the Director of Overseas Surveys under Barbara McHugo, who sort of organised all the surveyors going south. And she had a number of assistants over the years who liaised with Bass, Dr. Adie mainly. I mean, I didn't meet any of them until probably 1978 when I went back to Bass. But the geologists were always crying for more accurate maps, and the problem was that there wasn't sufficient control to make a map to the standard that the Directorate of Overseas Surveys were used to in other parts of the world. So they didn't like to produce maps when they didn't have the accuracy that they were used to, and they preferred to just not publish anything, whereas the geologists said any map is better than no map at all. And
so it was a matter of principle, was it really? That's
I think so, yes. And
they don't want to have their name, their initials on, yes, something which might be proven to be wrong later.
Yes, and Barbara was a little bit scathing about these sketch maps that we produced for the geological map.
Rightly so?
Well, no, because they were not meant to be topographic maps. They were geological maps, and we published them at half that scale anyway. So they weren't meant to be regarded in the same light as topographic maps, and we always made that clear that these were sketch maps. But if it was a map, it needed to be precise, according to Barbara. So there we are. It was a bit of a battle, really, getting them through.
So what were the early FIDs using? Theodolite, sextants, pigeons?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, I was not involved with that side of it at all, so it would have been that sort of work, yes.
And roll forward 50 years, what are the maps like now?
Well, I think they're brilliant. The when we set up MAGIC was when people were just going over to digital mapping. And so it was a big learning curve. You know, we had young people coming in who had been used to working with maps, but it was still, we were getting software up to speed for map making. And we had aerial photography and the satellite imagery, and it was still in paper form at that time. So it was only when we had digital satellite imagery and the proper cartographic software that we were able to produce maps ourselves and overlay different layers of information. So they can now be produced focused on a particular area. You know, if the scientist is going into the field, they can be generated to meet their immediate demands.
By the time you left BAS, were they perfect, or were mistakes still emerging? Well,
you will always get mistakes on maps, however carefully you look at them. Just some minor editorial things, you know, that stare you in the face once they've been printed. But when I first started with editing the geological maps, you know, the first draft coming back from outside cartographers, there would be about 300 errors. So it was quite a nightmare, and there would probably be two or three versions before we would publish. And then I'd see a mistake that I had made. You know?
Well, let's follow that process through then, from the primitive maps in the 60s through to the beginning of the 21st century when you retired. Can you pinpoint the kind of major developments, the major decisions that were taken that meant mapping got better and better?
I think one of the main changes from BAS's point of view was when it took over organising the mapping. Because before, we had always got the Directorate of Overseas Surveys. I think that stemmed from when BAS was a Crown agency, and so it was an overseas protectorate sort of thing. So DOS had always done the work, but then DOS evolved into Overseas Surveys Directorate as part of the Ordnance Survey and moved to Southampton, and the team really got considerably reduced in numbers. And so they were happy to then devolve the work to BAS. And that was, I was probably in the mid-80s, and that was about the time when David Drury became director, and he was a geologist, glaciologist, geophysicist, you know, earth scientist, shall I say. And so he was interested in getting the mapping with a bit more profile, and that was the start of really thinking about getting a mapping unit up and running at BAS.
Did he ring them, or did they ring him? Who initiated the transfer?
I don't actually know. I think it was one of those circumstances where they were really becoming a little bit defunct, or from the Antarctic point of view, they didn't have surveyors that went out anymore. I think the last surveyor that went to the Antarctic was 1975, something like that. So they had nobody who had real interest in the subject. And Barbara McHugo retired in 1984. So again, there was another link that went then. So it was about that time that you know, they were thinking they wanted to shed the work, and then we got a director who was interested in taking it on. So I couldn't really answer that question.
But you were very relieved, I would think, to take responsibility, weren't you?
Yes, indeed, because the geologists were still wanting to have decent maps, and all we had were these 1 to 250,000 sketch maps based on satellite imagery, which at that time was still... the resolution was poor. They were the early Landsat images, 1, 2 and 3. And I guess we got to about 30 metre resolution, but that was still quite poor for what the work that was needed to be done in detail in the field.
So when those first satellite images started coming back, were they more useful to you than, say, the work done by Fedasi, the aerial photography?
Yes, because they provided a much greater overview of the Antarctic Peninsula. And the Fedasi only went down to Marguerite Bay. So we had nothing farther south of Palmer Land or Alexander Island, apart from some American photography, but that wasn't as well constrained as the Fedasi stuff, so it didn't cover, and we didn't have access to it in the same way as we had for the Fedasi stuff.
So the establishment of the Mapping and Geographic Information Centre in 1989, that was a kind of a turning point, a bit of a revolution, was it?
It was. I think by that time, well, in 88, David Drury had agreed that, yes, we did need a mapping unit. And because it was the geologists who were crying out for the mapping, they had to give up some of their posts to make space for a mapping group. And it was a bit unfortunate because my husband was head of the geology division at that time, and he got a lot of flack from his staff because they were losing posts to mappers.
Were still his wife's mappers.
Yes.
You're getting sick, were you?
I wasn't, but he was. I mean, because they all had great plans of areas that they wanted to map geologically in great detail, they wanted to employ more staff themselves, and to have to give up five posts. In fact, we needed six, but we had to compromise and had five, so we could only employ two half-term people in to cover the depth of work, the range of work that we wanted to do.
Who was the arbitrator in that process? Was that David Drury's decision?
Yes, David said that if geologists want it, they have to give up the posts that they already have. So Mike couldn't do anything about it. You know, he just had to accept that, yes, they did need a mapping group. So at that time, we were embedded as part of the geology division because they were the main users of geographic information. And it was quite a struggle, really, to get the other science divisions to accept that they needed maps, but eventually they did.
Really? So they were perfectly happy not to have them, were they?
Well, the biologists worked mostly out of Cygni Island, and that was one of the rare places where there was a 1 to 10,000 scale map, so they were all right. You know, they got a reasonable map to work from for their surveys that they did. And it was only when they started widening their research into Marguerite Bay area, I think, that they began to appreciate the lack of maps that had been available at the time.
Who thought up the name Magic?
It was Mike and me together. I had thought of Magic, but I couldn't quite think how we could get the C, because there was Mapping and Geographic Information Systems. So Magis didn't seem to have the same ring to it, and I said to Mike, how do we get a C? And he immediately said centre. So that's what it became.
So 80% of it's yours.
Well, I don't know about that.
Did everybody immediately like the idea, or was it a bit of
Well, they thought, some of them, I think away from the geology division, they thought it was a bit silly, but I thought it was quite good because, you know, out of thin air we could produce a map eventually. So it was a bit of wizardry going on, especially as we were going into the digital era.
So when you sat behind your desk for that first year in charge of Magic, what were your priorities?
Well, I wasn't actually in charge of Magic the first year because it combined mapping and database work, and we had a geology database one of the geologists had become in charge of the, had taken on the responsibility of doing the geology database, Phil Marsh, and that was based on work that I had done when I was compiling the geological maps. I thought it was useful to have an overlay of where all the geological stations were and who had collected the data, so that we had some sort of feel for who had worked where and how many stations there were for coming up with the geological compilation that I had produced. And Phil thought this was useful to have digitised, so we had a number of casual labour come in to digitise that. And then he added information from the geological registers as to what was actually at that station. So he was gradually building up this side of geographic information, really, for a geological database. And he had the computing skills, and I didn't have any at the time. So together we put our heads together with Mike to come up with what would be useful for a mapping geographic information group. And so the six posts that we wanted to have were geological database and GIS manager, a topographic map compiler, a geological map compiler, a surveyor and a map curator, and then me in charge of the mapping production. But soon after we'd got everybody in post, Phil decided that he didn't want to stay in Bath, so he left. And we then advertised for a GIS manager to incorporate the geological database work. And we got Paul Cooper. So he and I were sort of running the thing for the first couple of years, I guess. And it was only later that, I think in 92, when David Drury said he thought that it was better to have one person in charge of a small group and asked me to become the head of it. So it was one of those sort of evolutions, really.
Where does Petra Searle fit into this chronology?
Well, she was one of the assistants to Barbara McHugo at the Directorate of Overseas Surveys. Her maiden name was Leigh, and she married one of the surveyors who had been in the Antarctic. And then she left to have a family, and there were two other lasses who came in over the years to fill in that post. The first one was a Caroline, and I don't know what her maiden name was, but she came back eventually before Petra to her name was Caroline Clark. And in the middle there was Liz Fleming. And then Liz Fleming left in 1981 to get married. Caroline Clark came back for 3 years, but she didn't want to move to Cambridge, because we were in Cambridge by then. And I was doubling up doing the work that Liz Fleming had done on mapping, as well as doing geological compilation. And Charles Swithenbank decided that we really needed to have somebody in post at Bass, and that he invited Petra Searle to come back for 4 years before she retired in 1988. So she dealt with all of the inquiries about topographic mapping and aerial photography, and liaised with the Admiralty about charts and aerial photography. And she worked for, I think, 3 days a week. And
okay, so you've got magic on the road, so to speak. You mentioned a while ago that there hadn't been any surveying done for a very long time.
Mm.
So there was some catching up to do, I presume. How did you go about? Did you have to start resurveying areas?
Yes, in a way, but not. It was using GPS, global positioning system technology, which had just, you know, was on the up and up at that time. there had been a problem with the oversnow traversing that had been done up to 1975, because they were covering a large area, and they were setting up local datums, and nobody had really put all of the network into one overall network. And somebody had tried to do this, readjusted all of the original control points, but there was a discrepancy of about 13 metres, I think. And they didn't like this at the Ordnance Survey, and so they wouldn't accept what he'd found. But it still was the best control that we had. But when MAGIC came in, we tried to get a surveyor as part of the team who would be able to go back in and reoccupy some of the major control points around the areas that we were working in. And we had somebody who was seconded from the Ordnance Survey, Andrew Perkins, and he not only helped get all of the control into digital form from the existing survey, but then he went every other year to the Antarctic with an air camera as well to take further.
So he was doing theodolite work on the surface of the...
No, he was using a global positioning system.
Thing. Right, so on the ground.
On the ground, yes. And also going up in the aircraft, the Twin Otters, to get aerial photography of the area that he'd been on the ground doing.
Was that relatively easily achieved, or was it difficult to get airspace and aircraft time?
It was quite difficult. That's why we only went every other year, because there was always a lot of requirements for the aircraft to deal with. And we didn't have an air camera ourselves, so we had to borrow one from the Admiralty. And they always put in requests for us to photograph parts of the coastline for their charting purposes. So it was they got the benefit of having an air camera in the Antarctic, but we had to squeeze our own work in as well as theirs, and within the remit of what air time we had available.
Mm-hmm. And there were other technological developments as well, mapping software and 3D visualisation, which you had to come to terms with.
Yes, well, it was a bit, I never really got to do the mapping software. I did try and get up to speed with it, but it was all... I never had time to be able to sit at it as much as I would have liked. And I was glad that I had Paul Cooper and Adrian Fox, who were both keen to learn all these new techniques. And well, Paul was already very good at computer software, and Adrian was keen to make maps, so he took on the software problem as well.
Were all these computer technology advancements all perfectly beneficial, or were there handicaps and drawbacks?
I think in a way we had been led into one computer package that didn't really fill the bill. It was partly a UK-based software product for cartographic work, and being set up in Cambridge, so it was local. But the international one at the time was ArcInfo, which was better for all our collaboration with our international colleagues, so that in the end we had to transfer. So that meant it was a sort of double learning curve.
Can you remember why the wrong package was chosen?
Not really. I think it was because it was UK-based and local that we thought that it would be better if we could just go down the road and ask people if things didn't work out right. but it was at a time when everything was developing and you never really knew which was going to be the best one to follow. And so a local product was probably, you know, the preferential one.
So it was so new that the front runner had yet to emerge from
exactly,
the pack.
Yes.
Rather like VHS.
Well, a low-cost one, that was the other thing. Mm. You know, we had limited finances and there was some very sophisticated cartographic software which was completely out of our remit, you know, price-wise.
But when it was working, what were the advantages?
What, of that particular software?
Of the 3D, of the software, the mapping software and 3D visualisation processes you had at your fingertips, or somebody else's fingertips, perhaps?
Well, that's a bit of a leap forward, actually, because at the time that MAGIC was set up, we didn't have any digital maps, so just getting anything into the digital
format
was an advantage. And I think we spent the first 2 years just trying to do that. Excuse me. We were also being asked to contribute to an international project, the Antarctic Digital Database, where we were getting all countries to provide their topographic data for us to either digitise or be in digital form. And until we had that in position, that was published in 1993, there was no way that we could really do any visualisation in 3D at all. And I suppose we'd really been going for 3 or 4 years before we got to that stage. So it was everything was trying to happen at once.
This is the Antarctic Digital Database you're
yes,
talking about now,
yes,
is it?
Yes.
Well, we'll come back to visualisation later on. I'm sorry if I got my chronology slightly wrong there. You were pulling together maps produced by several nations, which sounds like a bit of a patchwork quilt type job to me.
It is, very much so. There had been in the late 80s, attempts at getting world digital databases up and running. And it was so variable because a lot of countries had detailed mapping and others had hardly any. And then somebody focused on the Antarctic and thought this would be a good idea to get, you know, the first digital map of the Antarctic. And they couldn't get enough support for it. And the Scott Polar Research Institute got involved in that, and it fell over. And then another project came up, which evolved into the Antarctic Digital Database, and this was a consortium of the World Conservation Monitoring Centre, Scott Polar Research Institute and BASS. So there were three UK-based organisations with an interest in the Antarctic and the development of a topographic database. And the World Conservation Monitoring Centre managed to get funding from BP to help with this. And that's where I think Phil Marsh was still around when we were being asked about this, and we thought this was a good thing for MAGIC to become involved with. And I felt that if we were going to get anywhere, we had to get the map makers from around the world to contribute their data, otherwise it wouldn't have the same accuracy or usage. And by then I had become the UK member for the SCAR Working Group on Geodesy and Geographic Information. So at the first meeting I went to, I tabled the fact that the UK had got this group together and they wanted to make a digital topographic database. And to my amazement, they agreed. Yes, they would certainly contribute data, and they thought it was a good idea. And after that, it was a question of coordinating all of the Antarctic input. So that was my real effort into it. The World Conservation Monitoring Centre were managing the project, but I was managing the input of the data.
So you are receiving maps from all over the world?
Yes.
Drawn by different countries, but
yes.
Maps of the Antarctic,
yes.
Drawn by different people.
But some of them were just paper maps,
yeah.
So we had to digitise them in the UK. And there were two people at the World Conservation Monitoring Centre who did all the digitising, but I did all the proofreading. And if their lines were out, they had to redo them. It was not very popular.
Well, I was going to say, this sounds like a bit of a nightmare with maps coming in from all over the place. The background to which you may not be fully aware of. But were you getting stuff that was a bit shaky?
Not shaky, but it was all at different scales, and we had to produce something that it was the first seamless map, so that you could go from a part of the continent mapped by the Australians to a part mapped by the Norwegians and Chinese. And they were all done at different scales, and we unified them, and that's where the computer came in. It was able to do this.
There must have been gaps, wouldn't there?
Oh, there were gaps, and that's where we used satellite imagery to put in coastline and generate form lines rather than contours to show the topographic detail and the relief. Charles Swithenback was involved in that, he had a series of satellite images of the whole of the Antarctic continent. So he had got a coastline, and we digitised his coastline to improve quality of data.
Were some of the maps? Did you ever have occasion to reject a map? It just wasn't good enough.
No, I don't think we did that. But we did have a diagram to show the source of the data, and that showed the scale. So we had maps varying from 1 to 3 million, 1 to 5 million actually, down to 1 to 25,000. So there was a complete range. But most of the continent detail came from 1 to 250,000 scale maps, and the old geological sketch maps that I had helped prepare came in for the Antarctic Peninsula.
And when you published it in, I think, 1993, is that correct? Were you 100% confident about it, or were...
No, there was a lot of work still to be done. But it only had a life of 2 years, so we'd already overrun into 93. It should have been finished by 92. And we had different layers of information that we wanted to get in, including place names, and that led on to another SCAR project. But I think it was people wanted to have different subsets so that they could pull in detail if they wanted to, and we did generalizations to various scales. And I think there was one to a million was the most comprehensive generalisation we could do, and then 1 to 3 million and 1 to 10 million going smaller. And then Paul created some of these three-dimensional views of the whole continent, which were just fun to do, really. They didn't have much scientific value at that scale, but, you know, it was a start.
I'm intrigued that BP should sponsor you. This is my suspicious mind at work here, but was there a subtext to that sponsorship?
They maintained there was not.
They weren't rather hoping you might suddenly find a huge oil reserve.
They always said no, this was completely for the environment.
And what was your view?
Well, I think at that time it would have been impossible to do anything in the way of exploration for oil anyway, so I did take them at face value. One had to.
And were they good to work with, the sponsors?
Yes.
They left you alone?
Well, I didn't have much contact with them because it was an agreement between the World Conservation Monitoring Centre and BP for the funding. I think we did ask for a bit extra time, and I can't remember now whether we got any more money or not from them.
Are there any anecdotes about having to work with all these map makers in other countries? Did you come face to face with them from time to time?
Oh dear.
It doesn't have to be generative. Nothing springs to mind.
No, I can't think of anything. I mean, I did every 2 years we had meetings under the umbrella of the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research, and I, you know, my first one was when I asked them if they'd contribute, and the next one was in 92 when we were just about to complete the work. And in by the next time, in 94, we'd already published. So the real thing was to try and maintain the momentum and keep them interested, and whenever they did any improvements themselves, to send it to us to incorporate in the data, and that's what happened, so that they were always very supportive of the project.
So nobody seemed to mind that Bass was taking the lead role in this?
No, they were relieved, I think, that somebody was. But we always made sure that it was a SCAR product, you know, so that it was there for everybody to use, even though we were managing the data.
How has this digital database been used to expand the role of MAGIC? Were you able then to sort of spread your wings a bit more as a map-making company?
I think one of the things was an idea that Mike had, that we started what we called a dial-a-map series, where you could, all the different scientists, if they wanted a map of a particular area focused on their area of interest, then they came to MAGIC and said, you know, I want a map of this area. Please, can you produce one? Initially as a paper copy. But then over the years, when other scientists got more au fait with computer software, then it was digital data they wanted. And in the end, we were able to combine a couple of the posts. You know, there have been staff changes over the years, and when I left, we had one person, Peter Fretwell, who was able to do GIS work and generate all of these wide range of maps, and that was helped by Adrian Fox and his colleagues going down and taking aerial photography, digital aerial photography that would then be incorporated and into the map, so that you got an aerial photo as an image backdrop, and then line data overlaid on that. So it all helps with visualization of where you are, showing the crevasses as well. I don't know if Adrian told you, but there was one one year when he went down, and they were doing some mapping near Rothera, and there were a lot of crevasses on the way up to where they were wanting to take the put the control points in, and they made a camp and took various control points and then took some aerial photography. And when he was making the map, he realised that there base camp had been on a snow bridge over a rather large crevasse, which you couldn't see on the ground, but from the air was very obvious.
But crevasses, by definition, are moving, aren't they? If you map them, then 2 seasons later they've moved.
Yes, but that was just... it was trying to get plan a safe route over the crevasse field up onto the plateau from Rothera. That was the main reason why the base wanted to know where...
danger areas.
Yes, yeah. Yes. They chose a really dangerous area to camp.
I think the mapping came in quite useful when they were trying to site the Rothera Air Ops Tower. Is that right?
Yes. We had got a reasonable map of... of the Rother area, but then Adrian went and took lots of aerial photographs, and part of that season, I think he got the control in, so it all helped to visualise the terrain around the area and the airstrip.
So that was the beginning, perhaps, of maps being used for development, actually being used,
yes,
rather than just mapping for mapping's
yes,
sake.
Yes, yes, yes.
Sort of using maps to actually decide what to do next.
Yes.
because the whole business of where to build that new base in that part of the Antarctic was quite a debatable thing, wasn't it? There was some discussion about where it should go. Rather, it could have been built elsewhere.
Yes, but it that was pre-magic.
Right. but the runway, presumably, was during your...
Yes, because we have a before and after map of that. But that, yes, that decision had already been made, and we just helped to make it clear where the best place was. But then again, we were asked to produce a map of Sky Blue, which was a blue ice runway on Palmerland where they were wanting to get the Dash 7 to land. And again, we did some work for that and produced a map showing the extent of the blue ice that would make it safe as a runway, a landing strip.
Quite difficult to produce a map where nearly all of it is white, isn't it?
Ah, but then you can see that it's blue ice, you see, underneath, yeah. Because the aerial photography shows that up.
A bit more of the international liaison then through SCARP. Presumably part of the purpose of doing this was because the various countries are producing maps at their own need and duplicating the effort.
Well, it was to avoid duplication of effort, actually, that we bit the bullet about making the comprehensive digital topographic database, because Australia had been thinking about doing this for some time as well. And I think probably the Americans. So if everybody was concentrating on one digital database, then that did save a lot of effort.
And money.
But people, yes, and money. But people continued to enhance their own maps that covered their area of work in the Antarctic. And we did have... we participated in an international GPS program over a number of years, so that Andrew, when he went down, did take a few, occupy a few stations as part of that round the Antarctic network that was trying to be set up to improve the overall network around the Antarctic.
I want to talk to you about BEDMAP and also the coastal change maps, but which came first? Or were they both at roughly the same time?
Well, coastal change, I think probably came first, but didn't get published until much later.
What was the thinking behind that?
Well, the coastal change mapping project was set up by the United States. And they had been producing maps for a number of years. And because I liaised with the Americans quite a bit on the digital database and at SCAR meetings, I said, well, you could really do a lot of more detailed work in the Antarctic Peninsula, because they had just been using satellite imagery to produce their coastal change maps in Marie Birdland. And they said, yes, that sounds good, but nothing happened. And then I met up with Jane Ferrigno at a Antarctic geology conference in Wellington in 1999, and she was really masterminding this coastal change mapping project by then. And I said, is anything happening about doing the Antarctic Peninsula? You know, I think we really could... do much more detailed work because we've got the aerial photography from 1955-56 as well as the American photography farther south from the 1960s. So it's taking it back before satellite imagery, and I think we could get a good story out of it. And Jane thought that sounded good. But I said... we really hadn't got enough staff to be able to do this. And we came up with the idea of them providing us with money to have another member of staff employed to do just that work.
Alison Cook?
Alison Cook, yes. And she was brilliant at it. And did, I think it was 3 years. We I can't remember whether it was on a yearly basis that we had to get the funding. But a pretty daunting task, you know, this huge area to look at. And that's when the satellite, we got all the digital satellite imagery as well. So that helped with the, as a basis. And then she looked at the aerial photography to see what the changes were.
And she, we're talking about the peninsula here, or the
yes,
whole...
Yes, we are,
yeah,
yes.
Not the whole continent.
No, it was just the Antarctic Peninsula, and that produced 3 1-to-1 million sheets.
So there was a whole new mapping exercise, aerial photography or satellite mapping exercise of the peninsula, and a whole new map produced, and that was then compared to earlier maps.
She, yes, to begin with, she had the Antarctic Digital Database as the digital... basis for her work, and that had been produced by the Germans, actually, for the topographic database. They had done quite a bit of mosaicing of satellite images for their own work in the Filchner, Ronny Ice Shelf area and over into the Antarctic Peninsula. So they... provided a reasonable grounding for satellite imagery from the 1970s, 1980s. And then Alison used this and overlaid it on new imagery that we were getting from the Americans. And using, of course, the German mosaic had been... based on the control that we had in the Antarctic Peninsula. And then she had to sort of manipulate the new imagery and study old maps and the aerial photography to see the changes. So she came up with multi-layers of information and a mega database.
So you were the first people to see just how much the glaciers were retreating?
Yes. Although we had noticed this. I mean, when I was doing... geological compilations back in the 70s, we got a new image of Alexander Island, 1979, and the previous one had been 1973, and there we saw how much Wordy Ice Shelf was breaking up, and the northern part of the Georgia Sixth Ice Shelf had retreated, and various other locations. So we were aware that things were happening, and then on the Larsen Ice Shelf was beginning to break up as well. So there was a lot of documentation, and the glaciologists had also written papers about this. So,
but producing a map is quite a firm thing to do.
Yes.
It's a finite indicator, isn't
indeed,
it?
Indeed, yes.
Is that when the media began to pick up on it, when that map was published?
I don't think so. I think it was when the Americans usually, if there was any major breakout of the Larsen Ice Shelf, it always seemed to hit the headlines and the internet, you know, and people would pick it up. So we'd get people coming in and saying, you know, what's all this about the ice breaking up? But it had happened before.
Adrian Fox seemed to think that about 87% of the glaciers had retreated between the two sets of maps being produced. Is that your memory?
It's quite probable. I don't have that figure in my mind, but yes, I'm sure he's right.
What about the bed mapping project? Because this was to try and map what was beneath the ice, wasn't it?
Yes, well, that's where we were just acting as the map producers. So it was the glaciologists who had come up with all the data and then... asked us to make a map out of it. So it was a combination of glaciologists and our map compilers producing something that was rather beautiful to look at and also very scientifically instructive.
Maps are quite nice things to have. And when I went to the Antarctic in the year 2000, I was given a map of the Antarctic, which looked to me a bit like a tourist map. Was that something that you were working towards as well?
It was something that people were wanting us to do because the number of tourist ships going to the Antarctic was increasing quite significantly towards the end of the 90s. And the mid-2000s, it was, I think, quite significant, actually, number of people that wanted to have a map. We produced lots of little maps for them to put in their pockets, but we produced... we had one of the whole continent and one of the Antarctic Peninsula, and those were standard maps that even the DOS had produced. But ours were a lot more accurate by the time that we came to produce them because there was so much more knowledge available. But since I left, Adrian has produced a much better map with, I think, detail of the northern part of the Antarctic Peninsula, which is where most of the tour ships go to.
Was it a bit of a culture shock suddenly realising you were producing maps for sightseers? I mean, it's a good way of making money, isn't it?
Yes, but then maps were always very expensive to produce because until the tourists came along, you could only have a limited print run of probably 500 for scientific maps and maybe 1,000 for the more general topographic maps. And that's still very small as far as map producers are. Printers are used to running off. So we never really got much of our money back on those. So I don't know what the print runs are now. But it improved to be able, our capability to be able to print in-house, you know, using our own printers instead of having to go to a cartographic production firm.
Good for profile for bass as well, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Got tourists wandering around with bass maps in their pockets.
Yes. Yes.
Were you getting external funding from other sources and other projects as well? I presume that's part of your responsibility. And once we got past the millennium, everything had to be funded from different sources.
Well, the coastal change mapping was externally funded, and we were hoping to get some money from the Foreign Office to make a map of South Georgia, because, again, that was one area where there had been a reasonable map, but it needed to be improved for work that the biologists were doing there as well, and the Foreign Office needs. And we finally got approval for funding, I think, just as I was about to retire, so I didn't really see how that developed afterwards. That became Adrian's remit.
What was your greatest achievement in your career as a mapping guru?
Well, I think my biggest achievement probably was getting the opportunity to go and work in the deep field as a geologist, because that had been a no-no when I first joined Bass, and I finally managed to get there with the Americans, and that really was a fantastic experience. And one that I had begun to think I never would be able to experience.
And grappling with digits, because you are the generation that moved from pen and ink to computer programming.
Yes. I suppose, yes, that was quite a big challenge. And I still relied on my team to do most of the computing in that respect. I mean, I was okay with word processing and editing, but actually making a map from scratch was not something that I did very much of.
Did you have mixed feelings when you reached 60 and you were obliged to retire?
Yes, I didn't really want to retire because I enjoyed the international collaboration particularly. And also seeing how the team was progressing and achieving things for themselves as well as for Bass.
Were you able to walk away, or were you doing a Swithin bank?
No, having experienced that, I didn't want to be on top of whoever took over from me. And the fact that we also moved within a month of my retirement, you know, moved to North Yorkshire, which is quite a long way away from Cambridge. So I went back a couple of times for meetings with Jane Ferrigno and Alison Cook and Adrian Fox about the progress of the coastal change mapping, because that was sort of coming towards the end of its life from the funding point of view, but there was still quite a bit to do before they did actually get published. And that was a US Geological Survey publication, so that was out of our hands, but we still, you know, like to have a bit of input to it. And so I went down when Jane was able to get over to Cambridge. I went to Bass, but I haven't been back very much since then.
I've got a note finally to ask you about, I hope I got the pronunciation right, the Erewhon Nunatak. why am I asking you about that?
Well, that was part of the this deep field remote deep field work that I did with the US Geological Survey. And it was a pretty awful weather pattern during the whole of the program. And we went on various oversnow traverses to different nunataks, and we always seemed to set off in the sunshine and then get a whiteout within a few miles. And we were on skidoos, and I was always on skis at the back being pulled along because I didn't like driving the skidoos. My hands got too cold. And there was one traverse that we set out, and we were heading for a particular nunatak, and we went into a whiteout and we camped, and the whiteout lasted a couple of days and we hadn't a clue where we were. And then the whiteout disappeared and we woke up. It was brilliant sunshine and there were huge ice crystals on top of the snow surface because of the fog. And it was just fantastic. And then in the distance we could see a dark piece of rock, and we had no idea whether it was a distant mountain that we could see or whether it was a small rock close by. So a couple of chaps went out on a recce, and it was a small piece of rock about a mile away. It actually had significance because it had a fossil flora in it, which we hadn't seen anything like it before. And we looked at the aerial photographs, the American aerial photographs that we had with us, and we couldn't see where this little nunatak was at all. But when they got... We had camped in a basin, which is why we couldn't see any of the surrounding peaks at all. And when they got to this nunatak, they were able to get sightings of other peaks around. But it didn't have a name. And when we were all back in camp again, they were talking about giving it a name. And I said, oh, I think it should be Erewhon. And they said, what's Erewhon? Not having read the book. And I said, well, it's nowhere backwards, essentially. And unfortunately, they took me at my word, and they now write it as nowhere backwards, whereas Samuel Butler's book, it's WH is the reverse way round, because you can't pronounce it if it's HW. So the Americans have it as Erewhon HW, and we have it as Erewhon WH. So it really was nowhere.
You've left a little joke in the entire.
Yeah.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Janet.
Right, thank you.